Tonight, Ed T. from the 545 How It Worked group tell us his story. He got sober in 1990. So come on up, Ed.
I've been bugging Steve. He keeps asking me, are you ready for this? I said, what? Is that tonight? Is that this week?
Monday?
Is this Monday? Oh, man. My name is Ed Tainley, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm glad to be here, glad to be sober. If I hadn't been sober, I wouldn't have been able to come Saturday and hear Steve sing God Bless America. Did a great job. I was born. It wasn't hatched, I was born. April the 1st. April Fool's Day. 1943. For you that can't do the math, that's 83 years ago. I was thinking, you know, I was thinking about how I was raised, and I was thinking about kids today. You know, the kids today, they got these computer and high-tech stuff, AI, they do their homework with AI and all this crazy stuff, you know, and they don't even have to learn mathematics because they got the calculator in their phone, what have you. You know, they didn't have it like I did, you know. Now, when I was a kid, we played with frogs in the streams. We played with lizards. We played cowboys and Indians. We pulled little girls' pigtails. Yeah, they didn't have it like I did, you know. And look how I turned out. Oh, my. My sobriety date's May 18th, 1990. I've been in quite a few gated communities. Actually, five different states. That's how I got my wife. I told her I came from a gated community. You know, oh, my. You know, being 83, it puts a whole new meaning to what they say about, I've forgotten more than you'll ever know. I have forgotten. I can't remember my name, for God's sake. I was born in Baltimore City. My dad was a barber. I worked in his barber shop when I was 8 years old, shining shoes, sweeping the floor, washing the mirrors, what have you. And it was amazing how I would find quarters and nickels and dimes on the floor when I swept the floor all the time, you know. That was my dad's way of paying me, I guess. But I learned how to cut hair in that barber shop. And before I was hardly old enough to reach the shampoo bowls, I was doing shampoos and I was prepping customers for shaves for my dad to shave. I was also a pin setter in a bowling alley. Does anybody know what that is? And I shined shoes. I did a lot of stuff, cut grass, shoveled snow. I always had money in my pocket. Always had money in my pocket. I wanted to be a barber. My dad didn't want me to be a barber. He wanted me to be somebody important, like a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, you know, somebody that could make a decent living. I insisted on being a barber, though. When I was 14, let's see. Yeah, when I was 14, I decided to go to barber school against my mom's will. My mother was a cop, by the way. That was terrible. Every time I get stopped, you know, the police would look at my driver's license and they'd say, you're Rose's kid, aren't you? I was like, God, no, don't tell my mother. You know, just give me the ticket. But anyway, I started going to barber school when I was 14. I lied about my age. You're supposed to be 16 to go to barber school, but I lied about my age. One of the fellows that worked for my dad lied for me and told him I was old enough. Anyway, long story short, I went to barber school at 14, and that's when I started to drink, because the barber school was in a red light district in Baltimore. It was on Baltimore Street. And we had a free department in the back of the barber school. And that's where the hobos and bums and street people came to get free haircuts and free shaves. I used to get these guys to buy me wine. Thunderbird. What's the word? Thunderbird. What's the price? 30 twice. And what I do is I'd buy three bottles, and I'd give them one, and I'd keep two, and I'd put them in my suitcase, my barber case, and carry them home with me, and walk in and sit them on the floor right in front of my mother. You know, she had no clue what was in there. She would catch me all the time with cigarettes. I could hide them anywhere I could on my body. She would find the damn cigarettes. She never had a clue that I was toting alcohol. I was the supplier, you know. For the guys, we had a teen center. We used to walk the teen center. It was like about 4 miles, but we would walk the teen center singing all the old songs and stuff. That's where I met my first love. Her name was Vicky, and I was going to marry her. 14, I was going to marry her. I made up my mind. She was the girl for me. That was the way it was going to be. My mother, when she would punish me, whenever I get in trouble, my mother would put me in jail. She would take me down to her precinct, put me in a cell, sit me down and tell me that, you know, this is where you're going to wind up if you don't straighten your life up, you know? And she told me I'd never live to see 25. It's been a long time. My son was born June 6, 1961. His birth date is 6-6-60. And he showed it. God help him, he took after me. He's still practicing today. He and I actually used to drink together. But he's 65, my son is 65 years old right now. And he's never had a driver's license. The reason he's never had a driver's license is because he never could stay sober long enough between DUIs to get a driver's license. He was a habitual offender, spent a lot of time in jail, a lot of time. A few weeks ago, he got diagnosed with stage 3 liver cancer. And also, he has a tumor in his aorta, which is also cancerous. He decided he was going to stop smoking and drinking now. It's a little late. I started working in a barbershop in a little town called White Marsh. It was down on Chesapeake Bay. That's where I originally raised, was in Chesapeake Bay. I forgot. My son was born, was June the 6th, and June the 18th was Father's Day. Okay? So 12 days after he was born was Father's Day. My first Father's Day. And we were down at the beach. So we decided to go water skiing and celebrate, and we did. We water skied all day, and we would stop at the bars along the bay and pick up a case of beer here and there, and we all got pretty well snookered. And my buddy was back from the Navy, and he brought a friend with him on leave. And the three of us went out trying to find his friend a girlfriend. We were going to find him a date. I went to Vicky's house. She couldn't get out. We left there. We were coming up the road. It was a windy road that all down along the Chesapeake Bay. Those roads are like back roads. A car pulled out of a driveway in front of him and blinded him with his headlights. And he thought the road turned there, and he turned sharp to make the curve. And consequently, there wasn't any road there, so he went sideways into a telephone pole. They spent a long time trying to get me out of the car. I had a lot of friends in that area, and one of them happened to be a junk dealer and a tow truck driver. He had his own tow truck. They called him to the accident. When he got there, the firemen were trying to get me out of the car, and they were burning me out with torches. They didn't have the jaws of life that they got nowadays. And they were burning me pretty bad with the torches. And my buddy told him, says, look, I can get him out of there. Let me get him out. And they actually made him sign a waiver of responsibility before they let him try to get me out. And he hooked a chain on the car and pulled it away from the pole. And he took another chain and put it through the windows and yanked, backed up, put some slack in the chain, and then took off. And when the chain snapped, they pulled the door open, and I fell out on the ground. The driver, my buddy Bunky, he got 4 stitches in his elbow. But the guy in the middle, which was his buddy that was home on leave, was killed in the accident. When the cops got there, well, I don't remember but a couple of flashes in that thing after we hit. I remember an old guy, probably about my age, walking around the car with a cane and looking through the window and saying, you know, it's going to be all right. You're going to be okay. Help's on the way. You know, hold on. Help's on the way. And I went out, and next thing I know, I woke up 4 days later in the hospital. When I arrived at the city hospital, I had no heartbeat. And the cops took the beer cans out of the car and threw them in the woods and told my buddy that he was in enough trouble already. He didn't need that along with, you know, the DUI. That was the first incident, or the first red flag that said I might have a drinking problem, you know, because I didn't see anything wrong with that. It was just an accident, you know. It had nothing to do with all 3 of us being stone drunk, you know. Yeah, I lived through that mess. Where was I? Oh, got out of barber school, went to work in the barbershop in White Marsh. That's the reason where that went, because the volunteer fire department used to be right across the street from my barbershop where I was working. And they all knew me, the guys that were trying to get me out of the car, they knew me personally. And they said that I was complaining the whole way to the hospital about this new vehicle they bought was bumpy and it didn't ride. So I decided that I after working in this shop, I went from various shops, I was hopping around. I got a name for myself. Pretty good name, actually, in the business. I was working one day in a shop, and this lady called, and she said, you know, she said, I've got a building that my husband built for a barbershop. And this was in a little town called Bel Air, Maryland. She said, it was built for a barbershop, and he died before it was finished building. And I'm looking for a barber to open a barbershop in this shop. Would you be interested? You know, I've heard a lot about you, and I'd like you to come here and open a shop. I said, well, I got to see what I can do. So I went and talked to my mother, because I know my dad put money away for me to go to college, and I wasn't about to go to college. So I told her I wanted to open a barber shop, and she said, no. She said, I'm not going to help you. No way. Not going to happen. So I wanted to know how much money I needed, so I went to the barber supply. And a guy's name was Jack Kramer, owned the barber supply, and was also, unbeknownst to me, a good friend of my father's. So I went and told him what I wanted to do and wanted to know how much it would cost. And he said, you know, if you're a patch on your father's butt, he said, you're going to make it in the barbershop. He said, I'll put the equipment in there for you and I'll finance it. You know, so he put the equipment in the shop. Set the whole thing up. The first week I was open, I made enough to make the payments already. You know, I mean, it took off like gangbusters. And then the same guy came to me and he says, Ed, you know, he says, there's a contest in Washington, D.C. He says, I think you ought to enter it. And I'm like, hey, I'm in this little Hoboken town, you know, about like Stone Mountain is, you know. I mean, it was four blocks long, you know, the whole town. And I'm going to go to Washington, D.C. and compete? You're crazy. He said, no. He says, you got to do it, man. So he said, one thing, he said, I'm going to tell you, there's no electricity allowed. You have to do everything by hand, you know. So I had this old guy working for me, and I got him to teach me how to use those hand clippers. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen those or not, but I learned from him how to use those hand clippers. I went and competed in the contest. I got up there, and we all got boots about like this. We had to take a model with us. I had a model with me, and good thing cut hair. And I'm looking around, and they got hair dryers, and they got clippers, and everybody had electric equipment except me. And I'm like, holy shit! Anyway, I competed, and when we got ready to leave. My model that was with me, and I was sitting down in the audience, And this guy, his name was Ivan of Toronto. And he said, you know, my buddy says, come on, let's go. No, I said, let's go. And my buddy said, no, let's hang around. I want to see who won. I said, come on. We got a long drive back to Baltimore. Anyway, he convinced me to stay. Ivan of Toronto gets up there and he says, well, he said, I want to announce the first place winner first, so she get enough time to come up here and speak. He says, so first place winner is Ed Tingley from Bel Air, Maryland. At the time, that was the largest trophy ever awarded to a barber. It was 5 feet tall. I mean, now picture this. I'm already driving Cadillacs. I had a 1960 Cadillac Eldorado convertible. Like I said, I was doing pretty good in the hair business. I drove back to Baltimore, and we lived in a row home, and they had these concrete railings around the porches, you know. I'm up on top of the railing with a fifth of bourbon in one hand, and this monstrous trophy in the other, trying to balance myself on this damn rail and walking around here, saying, oh, if Daddy could only see me now, my father would have knocked me off of the damn rail. I think I passed the fact that my father died when I was 11 in the barber shop, and he and I were taking down holiday decorations when he dropped dead in the barbershop. Anyway, from there I went to another tri-state award in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Delaware. And I won that one. And that entitled me to go to New York and compete in the international. I competed in the international and I won 2 years in a row. I worked with Vidal Sassoon and Paul Mitchell. I was a color designer for Clairol Products. We had, 1 year we did this platform work up there. We had Clairol spelt out in big letters, I mean, tall as the ceiling. And they had a platform on the top and a ladder down the back. And we were taking girls out of the audience and matching their hair to the dress they had on, and sitting them up on top of these letters. It was really cool. We had all these gals sitting up there. It was a lot of fun. But I got to meet this guy. His name was Bernie Meyer. He was from Germany. And he wanted to get into the hairpiece and women's wig business. And he had the... He needed help. So the two of us got together and we decided we were going to get rich, you know. I mean, Vidal Sassoon went one way with his products and, you know, Paul Mitchell went another way with his products, and we decided to go our way with his hair products. We wound up with a manufacturing company in Baltimore, was our first thing, and he had a relative in Germany that had a wig company in Munich, and he had all this equipment. He was getting ready to redo his whole place, and he wanted to give us free this equipment. I mean, this machinery, you know. So this is a worldly opportunity, man. We're going to get in business for a little bit of nothing, you know. All we had to do was pay the freight. We paid the freight and got it all over here, and then we found out it was wired for German current. we had to change the motors and all that stuff. Wound up costing us almost as much as it would have been to buy it. But anyway, we got into three more different countries. We had our mother firm in Baltimore, and also we had in Baltimore we had a old Sears and Roebuck building that was 5 stories, and we had manufacturing on the top floor. On the first floor, we had a men's department. The second floor, we had a women's wiggery, and then also a women's salon, and we also had a beauty school in this building. We went another place in Munich, Germany, with his father-in-law. We opened another manufacturing company in Seoul, Korea. Now, we knew Seoul, Korea had some fine needle workers over there, and we wanted to, you know, take advantage of that. So, but we didn't quite know how to go about doing this stuff, so we flew over there, and we found somebody we could use as a general manager for that company over there. We brought him back to the United States, teaching him our methods and teaching him our machinery and how our operations work. And I'll never forget, because when he walked outside and he saw some stray dogs, he was like, who does them dogs belong to? You know? I guess it'd be like us finding a cow walking around the sidewalk. You know? I mean, they eat dogs. You know? It's just crazy. Anyway, we got that going, and then we got together with Jules Bernstein. Now, these guys aren't alcoholics, so I can't say their names, I guess. But I don't know, if you all have seen the advertisements on TV for Hair Club for Men, that's who Jules Bernstein is. Anyway, Jules Bernstein and our company joined forces, and we opened up another manufacturing company in Haiti. So we had one in Baltimore, we had one in Munich, we had one in Seoul, and we had one in Haiti. And we were doing great. All of a sudden, one other point I wanted to make was, when we were manufacturing in Baltimore, just to make a part for a wig, just the part for a wig, cost us at that time like $125. Now, if you want to know why we're sending work overseas, cost us $125. We could take the hair and the material, put them in a box, and ship them to Seoul, Korea, and get them back, material, labor, duty, and everything, $12. What would you do? You know? What would you do? Anyway, we got to rolling pretty good with that, and what was happening at that point, after we were in that business for a long time, and what happened at the end of it was that they started to sell these things in grocery stores and dime stores and what have you. They were selling cheap wigs, especially after synthetics came out. We were making these before synthetics were even invented. In fact, we were playing with synthetics. You're going to love this. We were playing with synthetics, and we were using fiberglass, which I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember fiberglass curtains. They used to stretch them across a wall in a room. It's, you know, just not for a window, just for decoration. Anyway, this fiberglass material was really much like hair, but it was real coarse, you know, and we just couldn't work with it. So we're stuck with this stuff we purchased. And we get this phone call, and long story short of it, we made the tail and the mane for Trigger out of that fiberglass that was too coarse to be human hair. We found a use for it. So if you ever get to see the stuffed Trigger, you'll know where the hair came from. Let's see, where do we go from there? God. Anyway, I became a 24-hour-a-day drinker. I drank when I was awake, period. You know, towards the end, when I got out of that business, my wife gave me an ultimatum. As the business was going down, my wife gave me an ultimatum. She said that, you know, the kids don't even know you. I had three kids. So the kids don't even know you. You're never home. You're overseas or flying around somewhere. You know, we had to fly back and forth to carry money, believe it or not. Banks didn't cooperate with banks overseas. So if you wanted money over there, you put it in a briefcase and hope the hell nobody knew you had it. And you get in an airplane and you fly over there with it. She gave me an ultimatum. It was either the business or the family. kids don't know you, you know. And I couldn't understand what the hell our problem was, you know. I mean, she had a swimming pool in the backyard that was taken care of. She had new cars. When my daughter was 16, I bought her a new car and paid cash for it. You know, what could a woman ask for? You know, what the hell does she want? A husband? So I opted to do that. And I opened a small salon. It wasn't a barbershop. It was a salon, men and women. And had this brilliant idea to have a bar in the salon. Customers would never know I drank, right? The women came in, I gave them some sangria. The men came in, I gave them a Budweiser. And they had a Budweiser to drink while they were waiting to get their hair done. I mean, hell, it was great, you know? Not too good for me, though. I went from there, I went on the road in sales, just trying to find something to do. My wife at that time had divorced me because, you see, we went from not seeing each other at all to seeing each other 24/7. She found out how much I drank. She thought she knew, but she found out how much I drank. And that was the end of that marriage. So I think that's when I really crawled in the bottle and I started working for this company. We were traveling all over the United States selling equipment. I stopped at my sister's house. You know, a lot of us alcoholics, we decide we're going to stay home and take care of our mothers. Yet my mom couldn't make it without me being there and freeloading. You know, well, I decided I was going to take care of my sister. My sister was going through a divorce and she was raising Tennessee Walker horses, and I knew she couldn't handle that farm without me, you know. I went and stayed with her for a while. I got a job as a district manager for Party Town Liquors. How about that for an alcoholic job, man? There was a company that waited on us and sold us booze. Took a liking to me, and he said, Ed, he says, we could use you in our company. Why don't you come sell liquor for us, you know, to these stores? So they gave me a job, and they gave me a company car. And I remember, like, yesterday, he told me, he says, I don't know if you can do this or not, but I want you to take a bottle of wine home with you every night and share it with your wife. You know, so you get accustomed to these wines. You need to drink them, you know, so you get accustomed. Guess I could probably do that. Only one? They went out of business when Lone Star, they geared up for Lone Star thinking it was going to be a Budweiser. And they spent trillions of dollars on trucks and delivery trucks and warehouses. And it failed. And the business failed. And I was out of work again. So, I went to work for a furniture company out of the newspaper. Salesman wanted, you know. But I went to work for a furniture company. Worked there for a while. Then I went to another furniture company. Then I upgraded to a waterbed company. I never forget, I applied for a job at this pest control place one time. And he gave me my resume. And he says, Eddie, I got a question for you. He said, most people, when they read their resume, it starts here and it keeps, you know, going up. He says, yours started here and it's going down. Could you explain that to me? I didn't get that job. I went to a doctor and the doctor, for a checkup, and the doctor said I had hypertension, high blood pressure, and if it didn't stop breaking, I was going to die. So he suggested that I join a church, a big church, and get sober with a church, which I did. Stayed sober for a year and a half with that church. Got to know everybody, got to know the men's in the Methodist men's group. Got a lot of friends in there. And we started a singles group. And we had a singles group about like AA. there was all age brackets from 70 to 16. I mean, you know, all different ages. Well, one of the parishioners of the church gave us two condos, one for the ladies and one for the guys, at the beach for the weekend. And the church gave us a bus. Well, I parked my car in the parking lot of the church, and I got on the bus, and I sit down next to a guy. Now, these guys are Christian people. They're not alcoholics, mind you. I sit down next to this guy, and he sits down there with a cooler full of Budweiser beer. Now, like Jim said, you know, what harm could hurt if I put it in milk, you know? What trouble can I get into drinking a beer with church people? Come on now, you know? I don't remember a damn thing about that weekend. I woke up in my bed. Didn't know how I got there. Had no idea where my car was. It was still at the church. They dropped me off with a church bus. Then I had to go back and face these people. That was a nightmare. That was my first sobriety. Year and a half. Went back out after that incident. I went back out and really... I stayed out for a while, and when I came back in, I was sober for about 3 months, I guess. I had this guy, George Bell, and he used to tell me, he started me out with, read page one of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I read page one, I got back to him, told him it was an index. He said, that ain't page one. Page one's a blank. He said, no, that ain't page one. He said, do you have a cover on your big book? I said, yeah, I still have it. He said, well, that's page one. And I looked at it. What he was trying to get to me was that's the place where it says that this is a textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, now, when you go to school, they don't just hand you a mathematic book and tell you to go home and learn it. They teach it to you. He said, that's my job as your sponsor. I'm going to teach you the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that's where we started. And he used to say things like, if it's not true, don't say it. If it's not yours, don't take it. If it's not right, don't do it. You can't change. I love this one. You can't change the people around you, but you can change the people around you. Think about that. Read that again. You can't change the people around you, but you can change the people around you. Love it. George was pretty good. We went through the fourth step. I got sober in Clarkston. I was sober about a month or two, and I got served with divorce papers. I didn't know I was married. That's the truth. I showed these papers to my sponsor, and I said, somebody's playing a damn joke. You know? I don't get this shit. Yeah. He says, no, really, he says, they're legal papers. You really got to take care of that. So I got a guy in the program. It was a lawyer that took care of it for me. I had to go to court. He said, which one is she? I don't know. I had no idea. Yeah. I was living in an apartment with another alcoholic, and we started getting gunfire and drug deals and all kind of stuff going on. I hit my knees. I'm going to run through this. I hit my knees one night, and I was taught that not to pray for things that you want, but you could pray for things that you need. And I was on my knees trying to convince God that I needed to get the hell out of that apartment. I didn't have enough money to pay another down payment on another apartment. I didn't have enough money to move if I had another apartment. I mean, that's where I was when I came in this program. I went to work the next day, and I was working for Haverty's Clearance Center. That's a sofa. That's a chair. That was my ability in the furniture business. And this guy was one of our, he had the vending machines in the back for the employees, cigarettes and all this stuff, and popcorn and potato chips. And the guys used to take the forklifts and turn them over and get the stuff out of them, you know. So he made a deal with me. He said, you keep an eye on my machines and I'll take care of you. And I was like, okay. So every time he'd come over, he'd give me a handful of candies and stuff, you know. And we were standing out on the back deck. This is the night after I prayed that. I was standing out on the back deck with him, and he said, Ed, he said, you know anybody who wants a house? I was like, what? He said, yeah. He says, I got a house I need to get rid of. I said, man, I said, I'd love to have one, but there ain't no way that's going to happen, you know. And he said, yeah, it can. He said, it's an assumed loan, military. I guess is what you call it. I don't know, but it was assumable. And the only requirements I had to have was a job and to breathe. I thought I could handle that. So I went and talked to the realtor. I went with him. We went to the realtor. We talked to the realtor, and the realtor says, well, she said, no problem at all. We can transfer it to your name, and you can make the payments, and your job seems okay. Everything's fine. He says, but you need to find somebody that can handle the package. What package? You know, I don't know what the hell a package was. You know, I had no idea. But I went back to my office at Haverty's, went in, shut the door, got on the phone, got the yellow pages out, and I started going down lawyers and asking them if they could. And I was telling each one of them that I'm an alcoholic in recovery and I don't have a lot of money. And I need a lawyer to handle the package. And finally, one of them said, look, I got somebody that might be able to help you. I'll have them call you. Give me your number. And I was like, yeah, don't call me. We'll call you. I got a phone call quickly after that. Guy said, look. Oh, and the prices I was getting on them, they're like $700, $800, $900. You know, it might as well have been $1 billion. And this guy calls me. He says, look, Ed, he says, I can handle it for you. He said, how does $75 now and $75 when it's done sound? Could you handle that? Well, I don't have $75. He said, well, give it to me when you got it. You know, whatever. I was like, man, this is cool. He was in the program. Mm-hmm. He was one of us, you know? Anyway, I wound up getting this house. This is how my brain thinks. I get this house for nothing. The payments on it were less than my apartment was. Okay? So me and my roommate move into this place. I didn't have a way to move. I went to Clarkson. I sit down in front of my guys and I said, look, I said, I need to move into this house and I don't have any money. Don't know how to do it. I had 7 pickup trucks show up from guys in the program. Bunch of women showed up in the program. They packed my stuff on the pickup trucks. The women packed my dishes, my silverware, and stuff in boxes, took it over to the house, unpacked it, and put it all away from me. Cost me a case of soft drinks and a bucket of chicken. And they wouldn't even take gas money. It was unreal. But shortly after that, I'm walking around the neighborhood. And I'm not promising you this will happen to you when you got that kind of sobriety, but it happened to me anyway. I'm going to tell you that. I'm walking around the neighborhood, and there's a house up for sale. Now, the balance that was owed on my house was $49,000. There was a house went on the market right up the street from me for $35,000. And my head's telling me, my God, look at all the money I'm losing. All the money I'm losing. Hell, I wasn't losing anything. But that's where my head went. But then I met this girl. And she was standing there talking to a couple of women about working out in the gym. And I thought, here's my move. I slid in next to her, you know. It's all sheepish-like and everything, you know. And I was like, I hear you work out in the gym. She said, yeah, why? I said, we'll have to work out together sometime. She said, all right. And I gave her my card. Because by then, I was working for another furniture company, and I was an operations manager. So, anyway, next day, I get a phone call. She calls me up, and she says, Ed, do you really want to work out, or are you just full of shit? I worked out. I went to work out with her. She set me in a machine, and I was used to dead weights, not machines. And she set me in this machine. It was a curling machine. And I'm sitting there in this curling machine, and I said, I don't know how to use machines. I used to dead weights. And she said, well, she said, I usually start out with 85 pounds, so, you know, that'll work out for you. Oh, my God. But we've been married 28 years now. I met her 30 years ago. We lived together for 2 years and got married. And we haven't had any children yet. She wouldn't hold still for it. But, you know, I used to walk around, when I had that townhouse, I used to walk around the circle in front of it, looking at the ground. A lot of you have heard this before. But I would look at the ground. I couldn't pick my head up and look straight ahead. I was that full of remorse from the damage that I had done. And I'd just stare at the sidewalk, walk my dog around a circle, and wonder, how the hell did I get there? A man of my stature, being homeless, you know. And I'm walking around there, and now Karen and I sit on the back porch of our home and look out over the lake, and we look at each other and go, how in the hell did we get here? You know, one day at a time. I sold that townhouse and used the money to build another house, and I built that house, and then I used the equity in that house to build another house next door that I rented out, and then we found the lake house. And was working for somebody else up the street, and they gave me directions over to this house to give this guy an estimate. And they said, you can't miss it. It's right across the street from an old abandoned lake house. I fell in love with it right there. Anyway, we got this old abandoned lake house for a little bit of nothing. We fixed it up, and that's where we're living today. And we're fixing to, I never thought I'd say that word. We're fixing to move up to the mountains. We found a place up there that we really like, and we love it, and we're going to sell this house and go up there, you know. But anyway, I think that's about as far as we can go here with being, you know, I'm sober today. Like I said, sober long enough to hear him sing God Bless America. I mean, that's a miracle in itself right there. I don't know if you've heard him sing or not, but...
It's amazing you didn't get drunk.
That was the point I was making. Anyway, I want to finish with this. I see trees of green and red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I say to myself, what a wonderful world. And I say to myself, what a wonderful world. Thank you.
First I slipped, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Take me where. Something that's